Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. As Ukrainian President Zelensky wraps up his tour of the U.S., where he's been petitioning lawmakers for billions more in military aid, some Republicans are balking and proposing to reduce that aid or even halt it altogether. They are not calling for negotiations aimed at ending the conflict. They just feel an isolationist approach would reserve more resources to address domestic needs here at home, needs they would not then vote to fund. They are hypocrites, as we have come to expect, but they are attempting to exploit a very real vulnerability created by the Biden administration, which has been pouring vast amounts of money into Ukraine's defense and also not calling for negotiations, thus perpetuating rather than resolving the conflict. In the end, both Republicans and Democrats are beholden to the same policy interests here, which is to weaken Russia. Mitch McConnell said it outright a little over a week ago as he supported a proposed new aid package, saying that the U.S. gets to, quote, weaken our greatest strategic adversary without firing a shot, unquote. Right-wing policy pundit William Kristol said the same recently in a policy memo outlining the strategy. The fact that policymakers are making these statements now overtly should lay to rest once and for all the question of whether or not the U.S. involvement in Ukraine is a proxy war with Russia. We'll have a recent talk by Professor Jeffrey Sachs on the matter in the second half of the show. WCRS-WGRN correspondent David Adelson returned this month to Tijuana, Mexico, to revisit the refugee shelters there, which are filled beyond capacity as the U.S. continues to forestall revising its immigration and refugee policies, thus worsening the crisis and pushing resources in Mexico to their limits. This, as Mexico has now agreed to deport a portion of the migrants back to the south at the behest of the United States. Here's the interview David has contributed.
This is Dave Adelson in Tijuana, Baja California, reporting for WCRS LPFM in Columbus, Ohio, and KPFK in Los Angeles. And I'm sitting with Luis Gomez and Sebastian Farias in Quinceañera Park here in Tijuana. We've just come from Templo Embajadores de Jesus, which is the largest of the albergues or migrant shelters here in Tijuana. Right now it's housing about 1,600, mostly Centroamericanos, who are awaiting their asylum hearing in a system that, frankly, is quite backed up. There are about 32 albergues, registered albergues, here in Tijuana. And Luis Gomez and Sebastian Farias work with Psicólogos Sin Fronteras, which is a nonprofit organization providing a variety of services to the migrant population. And they've been doing this for a number of years. We met in 2019 before the pandemic. So, Luis, do you want to talk a little bit first about what Psicólogos Sin Fronteras is doing?
Well, most of our work at this point in the project, it's been focusing on integrating. The key word there is integrating because we have been trying to do mental health services directly to the migrant community. But one of the things that we have discovered is that when you do only mental health, when you deal with only mental health issues, the part where it becomes important to cover first are the basic necessities. For example, if you go to a shelter where there's a lack of food and you want to do an intervention because someone is feeling depressed or sad for any kind of reasons because of the process of migrating, you will find that the first thing that you need to do is to cover the basic need of food because they're hungry, they need the food to feel good with themselves. So what we have been doing is working with other organizations and trying to integrate all those factors, medical factors, legal factors, food factors, security factors, in order for us to provide a better mental health service to the community. And it has been working. It has been working because it has led us to do a cooperation amongst organizations, and that way we can not only provide one factor of the situation that it's needed, but several at the same time.
So you initiated a Red de Apoyo de Migrantes, is that correct? And who's involved in that, and what is it doing?
well, the network was created by us because of the necessity that we discovered on the encampments. Mostly in encampments, the necessities are very, very real for them. They're living in lacking situations where they don't have a roof under their heads. They don't have enough food to cover thousands of people there.
Can you describe, you mentioned an encampment, and people may not know the distinction between the encampments and the albergues or the migrant shelters. What's the distinction?
There's a lot of differences. When you are covering an encampment, the situations are, how can I say it? They are at the mercy of the situation around them and at the mercy of the weather, at the mercy of every necessity that they need to cover. They live on tarps. They don't have a roof. They live under situations where organized crime is working all around them. So it's very different on a shelter. In a shelter, they have all these factors covered. They have a roof. They have security per se, because it's not always a secure place when you are living on a shelter. So there's a lot of differences, and the problematic, there's a more risk factor when you are in an encampment.
And so you started the network for the support for migrants during the El Chaparral encampment, where a lot, when they threw out the when Biden came in and said they were going to get rid of the procedures under the migrant protection protocols that had been brought in under Trump, everybody converged on the border thinking that that meant that they were going back to the system where you presented yourself at the border. And they ended up in this encampment on the street right next to the border for something like 6 to 9 months, correct? Just waiting, but it turned out not to be the case. Nobody could get through using that. So that my understanding is that they dispersed back to shelters, but now the shelters around Tijuana are basically all full. So there's both shelters and then encampments of people trying to get into shelters so that they can wait a long period of time, an indeterminate period of time, to maybe get an asylum hearing. Is that a good way of summarizing
that's
it?
That's an accurate description. There's other things that goes into play, because there's the political part where we have now the government going directly into the shelters, which was not happening before the pandemics. So now it's more of a political movement, and most of the humanitarian organizations are not getting that into that kind of dynamic, because it's not what we're doing it for. We're trying to do for humanitarian reasons to help people, but by now it's either you are on one side or the other, and that's not how it works for us. We are a neutral entity where we are trying to help people who is in need. And for them, the government part, they're doing it more for the numbers, because we are doing this, we're taking credit for this or for that, and we are not about that. And I'm not gonna be lying here, and I'm gonna be honest. Like, we do try to make our movement grow, and we try to make it seen by other people around us, but it's to create consciousness to help people, you know, to motivate someone else to be doing what we're doing, or you can join us and try to help people in the end. It's not a political movement per se. So right now, one of the factors that has been a real problematic is that government is getting directly into the shelters, into the dynamic of the humanitarian organizations, and they're in the middle. And some things are being blocked by them and because of them, and that's a problem for us.
So a couple things. One, we should clarify that the shelters are by and large run by independent humanitarian organizations and very largely churches. So, for example, there are evangelical shelters and Catholic shelters, and then some that are secular or non-denominational. But it's basically private organizations. There's also one or two government shelters. Is that correct?
Yes, there's government shelters are three of them, if I recall right. And those are working at the fullest, too. they're definitely working out the fullest. And as the same way as the private shelters, they are running with a lot of problems because of the lack of food, the lack of attention, the abuses that are happening in the shelter. So in both ways, I mean, you were mentioning before that about private shelters and how are they struggling to, you know, to get by, and because they, most of them are full. So that's where we go in. The humanitarian organizations are covering all those needs that governments are supposed to be covering, and they are taking credit for it. So humanitarian organizations are kind of on the edge about that, and it's causing a lot of problems.
So after such a long period of carrying the load on your own, now that the government has decided to put more effort into it, you'd like adequate recognition and cooperation as opposed to just being displaced.
And in the end, they are the ones taking credit for it. So it's kind of a thing here. We're getting sick of it, and it's...
Are you at all concerned that by saying this on in an interview that might be on the radio, that somebody would retaliate against you?
That may be, but how do you say it in English? No es algo ya difícil para nosotros.
It's not a big problem for you.
You know, because most of the organizations are lifting their voices about that. So if one other organization is just thumbs up for us, you know, and they may get mad with us and they may not want to work with us for some time, but when they need us, they will come back to us.
So let's talk a little bit about how the situation's evolved over the last few years. So when I first came down here in 2019, we went to Templo Embajadores de Jesus, and there were, and Little Haiti, which is attached to it. And there were about 300 to 400 Centroamericanos and 50 to 80 Haitian people there. Now we just went there today, and there were on the order of 1,600 people in the shelter. So has the migrant flow continued and then just stacked up to the point where it's all full now, and are people continuing to filter into the city and ending up in encampments, or is it kind of a stable situation right now? Are things improving or getting worse? How would you characterize what's going on now?
It's not a stable situation, definitely, because you have to take into consideration that by now the U.S. government are only allowing 250 people per borders to cross every day.
When you say per border, you mean per border crossing, like Otay Mesa and San Ysidro?
No, for example, Tijuana is 250 in general. And not even Mexicali, I think Baja California in general. And then Juarez, another 250. And then Monterrey, another 250. It's just per border, it's 250. And what I mean per border is by state.
And so by area, essentially. Do you have an estimate of the approximate size of the migrant population that's waiting to cross across these four states?
To cross to the U.S.? I can do the quick math, taking into consideration the people that are into shelters, because most of the people that are living in shelters are the ones waiting for their asylum process. So if you take into consideration that we're working with 18 shelters in total, some of the shelters are sheltering 1,600 people, some of them 250, some others 120, some others 45, some others 75, the math would be like around 4,000, 5,000 people every day. And every day, people from different countries and states from Mexico keep coming. So it's growing constantly. That's another problem, because the caravans are getting together in Honduras, Salvador, and they are coming to Tijuana. This is like one of the places that are sheltering most of the migrant community. So, yeah, it will keep growing.
And are there substantial numbers of people coming from Africa and now, for example, the Slavic regions as well?
Yes. We have been working with shelters who are helping people from Ghana, helping people from Africa, helping people from Afghanistan, Egypt, Uzbekistan, Ukraine, and Russia. So there's a lot of different countries migrating to cross to the U.S. And the thing is that during the pandemics, the process was kind of an easier process because we were doing the work that the U.S. were supposed to be doing. So we were crossing around 150, 250 people every day amongst other organizations that were doing that we were doing the same thing at that time.
When you say crossing, under what provisions?
Exception of Title 42. Exception of Title 42 allowed people to cross the border and start their asylum process in front of a judge through the legal system in the U.S. Illegally.
And what qualified somebody under Title 42?
There was, at that time, it changed by now, but at that time they were supposed to be in a vulnerable situation where they were running from organized crime. What was the other... vulnerabilities.
The organized crime recluse the little boys, the young boys. So when they didn't want to work with them, they probably were killed. So the families decide to come here with their children in between 10 to 15 years old. And that was a big problem because they were being heavily recruited to work with the cartel.
So they have to be in a vulnerable situation, plus they have to have a sponsorship in the U.S. where they will be taken care of, because under that provision, they weren't allowed to be working in the U.S. They were supposed to be taken care of by the sponsorship for a year. And it all depending on how much time it was going to be spending going to court, because some of the cases extended even to 3 years. So as long as they were doing the process under the court or before a court, they were allowed to be staying in the U.S. legally. Legally, it's just the saying, because, you know, they were not allowed to cross certain lines of, for example, if their sponsorship was in California, they weren't allowed to cross the line to California to another state. So there was a different several characteristics that they needed to fulfill in order to be to apply for that particular exception to Title 42.
So I just want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Luis Gomez and Sebastian Farias here in Tijuana, and we're talking about, they're both with Psicólogos Sin Fronteras, a humanitarian organization based here in Baja California. It's an international organization, but Luis is the head of the local chapter here in Tijuana. And I wanted to ask how, now Title 42 has now been terminated, right? So people aren't crossing under that provision anymore. And I understand that the Customs and Border Protection has established an app called...
It's CBP One.
And CBP One is the way that people essentially get in line for their asylum hearing, correct? So how is that process working, and how has that changed the work you're doing? Or, you know, would you say it's overall been a positive experience, or how would you describe what's going on with the process at this point?
I'll be honest, like, it really helped a lot of the wake that we were taking care of, because we were doing the work that they were supposed to be doing, like giving up the numbers, giving up the entrances. We were taking people from the shelters to the border to hand it out to the authorities in the U.S., in Mexico, excuse me, and then they were handing it out to the authorities in the U.S. So when they implemented the CBP One, the whole process is dependent on the centralized system that the CBP created. So now no one is in charge of that particular process but the authorities in the U.S. That way, a lot of the problems that we were seeing before the CBP One was frauds, people abusing the migrant community by charging them money, and by now that's not happening. And even then, we have the doubt that some people are even try to abuse the migrant communities by charging them to fulfill the form that they can do by themselves, because they don't know how to use the technology, the phone, or stuff like that. So it's a constant problem, but it changed the dynamic Totally. Because before the CBP one, the encampment, Chaparral encampment, for example, was created solely for the purpose of people putting pressure into the United States authorities for them to letting them cross. And that was one of the reasons why some of the processes that CBP implemented was based on that situation itself. So now they're going to shelters, because shelters are helping people in an honest way to wait for their cita, it's
their appointment
with the U.S. And that's a good thing, because now no one is in control but the ones who are supposed to be doing the process, which is CBP here in the U.S.
Now, I understood that there was a period where they were giving identity cards and allowing people to actually work while they waited. What's the status of that right now?
That's still working here in Mexico, yes. It's still working. People are applying for temporal citizenship here in Mexico, and once they get that, they can start working legally. Otherwise, they're doing the same thing that they're doing in the U.S. Since they're already here, some of them are working just like that. They can get jobs with in an unofficial manner, and some of them have to survive, so it's understandable that they're doing it that way.
And what is the relationship of the migrant community to the larger local population here in Tijuana? Different people have different attitudes, but generally speaking, is it sort of something that's not really visible to most of the local population? It's out of sight, out of mind, or is it something that people are very conscious of here? And what's the attitude of the local population to the migrant population?
That's a very complicated question, because socially speaking, I cannot say that I can understand the whole picture of it, but I can tell you from my own experience working with migrant communities that are already working and living and studying in Tijuana, that you still can see a lot of rejection from society for the migrant communities. Some of the commentaries you will see, or you will hear, or you will see on social media, is that they are taking our jobs, they're not doing enough, people are not here to work, they are here to steal, they are here to kill. The same story that you can hear in other countries, you can hear it here in Tijuana, in Mexico. So, and like I mentioned before, that's only a little bit of a part that I can see and in my own experience, but I can't say that for everyone here, because I know there's people who understand the situation and helps migrant communities, give them jobs. You know, it's difficult to generalize something like that, but it does happen.
What would you say about the spirit, essentially, of the people in the migrant shelters right now, in the albergues? And if you could comment on whether it's changed or not, is there a sense of hopefulness? Is there a sense of solidarity? Is there a sense, is despair the preponderant emotion? How would you describe how you feel about how they feel?
That definitely can give you a better perspective of it, because we attend several shelters, at least 14 a month. So we have the chance to constantly talk to people in the shelters. And one of the things that you will perceive in their tone of voice, their stance, the way they speak, it's desperation by now. Because taking into consideration that only 250 people daily can cross the border, and taking into consideration that there are thousands of them waiting for the appointment, some of them are desperate to, you know, what's happening, anxiety, depression, what's going to happen with my life. They're constantly asking, what can I do different that will help me to cross easier? So there's no easy way by now, because Title 42, it's over, and exception to Title 42 along with them, with that process. So there's other processes that they can do, but those are processes that takes years, you know, humanitarian paroles, all those processes, it takes years, and they have to wait in the border or in their country for an answer for their asylum petition. So it's desperation mostly. It's you definitely can see that in the situation they're living.
And yet the population keeps swelling because the processing numbers are, I mean, the number of people processed is not equal to the number of people who continue to come. Where do you think this goes, given that the population keeps swelling and the situation in the shelters is that level of, you know, despair, let's say, or I don't want to say hopelessness, but anyhow, where do you think this is headed?
Well, that's a big question, and I think that's, if someone can answer that question, we'll have the solution to the problematic. But in general, I think it's heading to getting a little bit worse, because you have to remember that. And this is what I don't like to answer this question most of the time, because it gets into a political statement mostly. Because if the U.S. cannot find a way to provide the security and the sense of that they are really helping the people, the millions, the thousands of people that are arriving in the different borders, it's going to keep growing, and people keep migrating, and people want to cross to the U.S., and that's their goal, and you cannot change their minds. We have tried many different ways to try to give them a better perspective or a broader perspective so they can have more options where, I mean, they can live in Mexico, they can work in Mexico, they can do a life here. They can, if they don't have a vulnerable situation in their country, they can go back and do well by themselves. But in the end, they just want to get better in their life, to have a better, a better quality of life. And the U.S. and the American dream, it's the dream, you know, the dream, and they want to get there. So it's a difficult question to answer.
What is the role of organized crime right now, and how prevalent is organized crime in the migrant community? I mean, like Sebastian mentioned, the recruitment of young kids, mainly boys. How strong a force is organized crime in the shelters and in the encampments?
Depend on the side that you're working, because I'm going to give you a bit of an example, and this is directly our experience. For example, when we were doing our job as the carriers of the Title 42 exemption, along with other organizations, we were doing the field work directly with the migrant community, and we were being threatened by organized crime, and we still kept working, but you know, it's a danger, and it's palpable, and it's something that it's there, and you cannot just get blind to the weight of it, and especially in areas where we work, where shelters are, and it's something that is real, very real, and you have to be very aware of it.
And you were being threatened for what reason?
Because we were helping people. Remember that. In the area that we were working, it's in an area where organized crime takes control of, you know, coyotes and all that stuff. So if you're taking their business, doing it for free without charging anything, you are a threat for them. So we were a threat for all of those people who were working that side. So, you know, the good thing is that at one point we still kept going. I guess they took into consideration that we were a humanitarian organization, and we were doing it by heart, and we were doing it for honest reasons. And, you know, I want to believe that that's what helped us keep our work going, because we were literally were being threatened, death threats, like, if you don't stop, we're going to be doing something to you guys. And we don't know if it was true at one point, but we kept receiving those threats. So
how can listeners, if they want to support your work, find out about you and get in touch with you and provide support?
You can find us on social media. We are in most of the social media. We like to do our work visible to create a more consciousness about helping vulnerable communities. And you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I think it's X now. It changed. So X and in general, Google. If you want to help us, that's something that we always receive, but that's not our purpose. That we're going to keep doing our job here.
And so that's Psicólogos Sin Fronteras Baja California, Psicólogos Sin Fronteras BC. And Sebastián, I've been talking to Luis most of the time. Do you have anything you'd like to add that you think about the situation that you'd like to let our listeners know about, that you think they should understand about the situation down here and your experience with it?
Yeah, well, I can tell you about my work as a psychologist on the shelters. So my job is basically when I work with kids, we work through play with games. So our objective is to integrate the whole pack of kids, because there are sometimes 20 kids, 40, 50, and 100 and plus kids in one shelter. So we try to make them feel like a team. So they talk each other, they help each other, they respect each other, and so they don't fight in the shelter. We try to them, so they avoid fights, problems, screaming, crying, and all those things that upset the parents, you know. And if the parents are upset, they fight each other and create more problems. So we kids, we try to integrate it so they respect each other. When I work with the adults, I work through like a psychologist. I work with this model, which is behavioral cognitive therapy, and I try to calm down these symptoms of anxiety, depression, and sometimes some obsessive thoughts about fear. And the first session is to release all those thoughts. So I let people to talk about the trauma. I let them to cry, to tell me these histories. And through this model that I mentioned, I work with their thoughts and try to change some ideas of life, of violence, of work, of Mexico, of the U.S., you know. So they go through this process freely and feeling better about themselves and about their whole family, because they all suffer something in the way to get here to Tijuana. So that's individual therapy. We do 4 to 3 sessions, and the objective is to the families to feel better, to work their way through and find the best help they can get, you know. We give them information about all the processes in real time that are available for them to apply for asylum, apply for job visas, apply from residents, Mexican residents, work permits, whatever we can get for them, we will give you the information. And we also work with them like us as a person. And with the kids, we sometimes do like art things, so they also can release this energy, this trauma. They talk about their experience, because kids being, I don't know, abducted. They've been trying to recruit for work the organized crimes. They see their parents die and a lot of things, you know. So the kids also have trauma, and we work through art, through play, through speaking, you know, visualization, relaxed techniques. We do all this kind of stuff so they can get more calm and start to feeling again themselves, you know. So they go through all this. And that's my job, basically, when I'm in the shelters.
That's beautiful work. Thank you very much for describing it. And I hope our listeners can find a way to support your guys' work going forward. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you, too.
Thank you for all the help that you bring us to here to Tijuana. We are very appreciative of it. And as always, we love to work with organizations like yours, because they always come here to really help people and not to, you know, try to get the picture, get real help in real time for the people that need it. Thank you.
It's our pleasure. Thank you. This is Dave Adelson signing off for WCRS-FM in Columbus, Ohio, and KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles from Tijuana. And thank you very much for listening.
We'll follow up on that situation whenever David Adelson can provide us with an update. Thank you, David. Here then is Professor Jeffrey Sachs on the latest status in Ukraine and the ongoing U.S. policy failures there that are costing lives and resources and creating unnecessary hardship globally, according to Sachs's analysis.
Greetings to all of the participants in this very important conference. I think there is no more important activity for us than the pursuit of peace. As we speak, we know that Ukraine is suffering, and tens or hundreds of thousands of people will die in the coming weeks and months if the war continues on its current trajectory. Indeed, the whole world is at threat because this war could escalate to a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. Have no doubt that we are on a continuing path of escalation. Peace through negotiation is not only possible, but it was nearly achieved. Though, alas, our mainstream media in the US and Europe don't report basic facts anymore. Peace through negotiation was almost achieved in March 2022, just after Russia's invasion. Because in March 2022, the Ukrainian government and the Russian government exchanged documents and negotiated an agreement with the mediation of the government of Turkey and the informal mediation of then Prime Minister Naftali Bennett of Israel. This agreement was nearly reached and signed. And though you cannot find it in the press, the United States stopped the negotiations. It's very important to understand that. It's very hard to understand that through the wall of falsehoods and the wall of deception that surrounds this whole war in the West. The United States has not wanted a negotiated end to the war. And if we return from March 2022 to 3 months earlier, a negotiated settlement before the war was absolutely possible, again, not reported in our media. On December 17, 2021, President Vladimir Putin put on the table a draft U.S.-Russia security agreement. At the core of that agreement was that NATO would not enlarge to Ukraine and to the 2,000-kilometer border of Russia. This was not only a concession that the United States should have made to avoid war. It was in America's interest, in Ukraine's interest, in Russia's interest, and in the world's interest. The idea that the United States should push its military alliance, its weapon systems, its bases up to the Russian border is mind-boggling in its recklessness. President Putin put a proposal on the table. I called the White House soon afterwards and beseeched the White House to negotiate on that basis. I explained to the White House how would the United States feel if Russia had bases in Mexico or China had bases in Mexico. The last time that was tried, the United States invaded the said country, which was Cuba, 60 years ago. The White House told me the U.S. will not negotiate with Russia over the enlargement of NATO. I said there will be war if there is not proper diplomacy. The White House did not want to avoid this war through diplomacy. It either thought that it could call the bluff of President Putin or have the war and accomplish what our defense secretary, better to say our war secretary, Lloyd Austin, publicly stated, and that is that the goal of this war is to weaken Russia. If the Ukrainians die and if Ukraine is destroyed in the middle, that's what a proxy war is. All my life, 68 years, I have witnessed U.S. proxy wars in Vietnam, in Laos, in Cambodia, in Nicaragua, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, and now in Ukraine. The United States is not thinking about Ukraine. It's thinking about weakening its adversary, or its perceived adversary, Russia. So diplomacy was stopped by the United States in March 2022. It was rejected by the United States in December 2021. And it was rejected by the United States between 2014 and 2021, because when the Minsk I agreement and Minsk II agreements were signed, the United States supported the government of Ukraine to not honor the agreement that Ukraine had signed. The purpose of the Minsk II agreements was to ensure the language and cultural rights of the people of the Donbas or Eastern Ukraine, overwhelmingly Russian ethnicity, with a system of autonomy, which the government of Ukraine agreed to, and in which France and Germany were to be the guarantors, and in which the entire UN Security Council unanimously backed. And the Ukraine government said, no, we don't want to implement what we have signed. The United States said, fine, we will send you arms. You don't have to implement that, even though the UN Security Council had signed. So, in fact, the rejection of diplomacy goes back to late 2014 and early 2015. But in fact, the U.S. rejection of diplomacy goes back even further. It goes back to February 2014, because in February 2014, again, never explored in our mainstream media, but obvious to anybody paying attention, the United States conspired to overthrow the government of Viktor Yanukovych, who was pursuing the path of neutrality in Ukraine. And if that sounds shocking, please go back and listen to the conversation between the then Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, and the then U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Piat, which took place 3 weeks before the violent overthrow of the Yanukovych regime. In that call, Victoria Nuland described who would be the post-Yanukovych government. Again, I'm 68 years old. I have lived through dozens of U.S. regime change operations all over the world. I've seen some with my own eyes. And this one I saw very close up. And of course, there was a violent insurrection 3 weeks after the intercepted call. And the government that was brought into place was exactly the one that Victoria Nuland, as Assistant Secretary of State, had described on the call to the U.S. ambassador. I was in Kiev soon afterwards. I learned firsthand how U.S. funding from so-called NGOs had paid for a lot of the so-called Maidan revolution. This was the trigger of the war that really started 9 years ago. Again, it was a rejection of diplomacy by the United States because the sitting president of Ukraine wanted neutrality, whereas the U.S. government wanted NATO enlargement. That means that this conflict actually dates back even earlier to 2008, we can go, because in 2008, George Bush put on the table that NATO would enlarge to Ukraine and to Georgia. If you look at a map, the U.S. plan is absolutely clear and follows a line that had been spelled out a decade earlier by Zbigniew Brzezinski, the national security advisor to Carter and one of the leading U.S. geostrategists. The idea was to encircle Russia in the Black Sea region, because with Ukraine and Georgia joining NATO, Russia would be encircled by Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey, and Georgia in the Black Sea. The idea clearly stated was to bottle up Russia so that Russia was no longer any problem to U.S. policy. Where did the U.S. want a free hand? It wanted to be able to replace governments at will in the Middle East. For example, overthrowing Saddam Hussein in 2003, overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, a NATO exercise, by the way, not just a U.S. exercise, but a NATO exercise, overthrowing Bashar al-Assad in 2011. This is another point that's misunderstood. Bashar al-Assad and the so-called Syrian civil war is a U.S. regime change operation gone terribly wrong. The idea was that the CIA would work with the regional governments to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. It failed. Several years later, Russia came to the assistance of its ally, and then our media pointed the finger at Russian intervention, ignoring the U.S. intervention beforehand. There has been almost no reporting about the basic fact of Operation Timber Sycamore, which was a order by President Obama that the CIA would overthrow Bashar al-Assad. I know a lot of this also directly from people who were absolutely involved and trying to stop the war, but the United States opposed diplomacy. We can keep winding the clock back to truly understand what this is about. The U.S. at every stage has rejected diplomacy, and it goes back to actually 1990. In 1990, incidentally, I was an economic advisor to President Mikhail Gorbachev's economic team. Gorbachev wanted peace in Europe. He wanted a common European home. At that time, the United States and Germany promised explicitly that NATO would not move one inch eastward. That was a lie and a phony promise. Gorbachev disbanded the Soviet-led military alliance, Germany reunified, and by 1992, the United States was already planning the massive expansion of NATO all the way to Ukraine. Historians are finding in the archives that the plan to expand NATO all the way to Ukraine dates back to 1992. Incidentally, Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote in 1997 in Foreign Affairs a very clear article that lays out the explicit timeline for NATO enlargement, saying that between 2005 and 2010, Ukraine would join NATO. And of course, the invitation pushed by the United States came in 2008, just on Brzezinski's timeline. And note, this is well before Putin. This is well before any supposed threats coming from Russia. This was U.S. military expansion planned for three decades now, and nothing is to stop it. Not diplomacy, not negotiation, not avoidance of war, not any truth-telling in the newspapers. And while the Standard may call this a propaganda event, I would welcome a public discussion with the editor of the Standard at any moment to discuss these issues. Because these are facts. This is the history. This is not what's reported in our mainstream media now. Our mainstream media makes a false narrative that this war started with a, quote, unprovoked invasion on February 24th, 2022 by Putin. That is the official Western narrative. The New York Times has repeated that claim 26 times in its editorials and its op-eds, but it never allows anyone to tell the real history in the pages to the readership. And this is what's happening all over the U.S. and all over Europe. We're talking to ourselves. We are leading to the destruction of Ukraine, because there is no way in the world to have a military victory over Russia with NATO enlargement as the end result, because Russia will continue to escalate as needed. Perhaps Russia will simply defeat Ukraine on the battlefield. That is quite possible. But if not, Russia will escalate. And Russia has 1,600 deployed nuclear weapons. President Obama, though he contributed to this overthrow of Yanukovych, was also very clear in 2014, do not get into a war over this issue, because as he put it then, Russia has escalatory dominance, meaning they can always raise the stakes, up to and including nuclear war. We are on a reckless path based on falsehoods. This war could have been avoided at countless stages in the last 30 years. This war should never have broken out 9 years ago, because the United States should never be part of violent overthrows of other governments, but it's a bad habit of the United States. Europe should have enforced the Minsk II agreements, backed by the UN Security Council, signed by Ukraine, instead of ignoring them, laughing at them. But the United States said, no, you don't have to follow those. We will arm you. The United States should have negotiated at the end of 2021. The United States should have applauded rather than stopped the negotiations in March 2022. So till today, there is a negotiating path that has been on the table. At the core is neutrality of Ukraine to keep the two nuclear superpowers away from each other. It's common sense. It is what the United States has demanded for two centuries in the Western Hemisphere. If the U.S. neoconservatives were not so arrogant, reckless, and blind, it would have been agreed a long time ago. Till this moment, it is possible. NATO, however, which is a U.S. military alliance, insists that no third country, that is Russia or anybody else, has any right to have any say to where the U.S. military alliance goes. That is reckless, and it leads to war. And now have no doubt about the U.S. irresponsibility, which is trying to place NATO offices in Asia. I think not even remembering that it's not the North Asia Treaty Organization, it is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It is not an expeditionary force for U.S. hegemony. It was meant to defend Western Europe against the Soviet Union, which no longer exists. And yet the United States is trying to expand NATO now to Asia to fight China. Europeans are aghast, but the media are not explaining what this is about. And they are certainly not telling the truth that the war in Ukraine is a disaster that came from the unrelenting arrogance of the United States to keep pushing, provoking, and to avoiding every possibility of a diplomatic off-ramp. So let us help people to understand that negotiations till this moment are feasible, and that President Biden needs to step forward and say NATO will stop its enlargement if Russia leaves and ends the fighting. And this will be the basis for peace. Let me close by noting that today exactly is the 60th anniversary of the greatest speech by any U.S. president on peace, John F. Kennedy's peace speech, given June 10, 1963, at the height of the Cold War. And what President Kennedy said is precisely relevant to us today. At the height of the Cold War, he had the clarity, the honesty, the eloquence, and the leadership to say that the Soviet Union did not want war, the United States does not want war, we can negotiate peace. And President Kennedy called on Americans to reconsider their attitudes to the Cold War and to the Soviet Union. President Kennedy said we should hail the Russian people for their vast achievements in science and industry and culture. At the height of the Cold War, he dared to say this. He knew that the military-industrial complex opposed him. He knew the generals resented a peace initiative, but the American people overwhelmingly supported it. And 5 weeks after President Kennedy's brilliant speech, which everybody can listen to online, Kennedy and Khrushchev signed the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And President Kennedy made a campaign in the United States over the heads of the military-industrial complex to speak directly to the American people that peace is possible, that the U.S. and the Soviet Union have a mutual interest in peace, that an agreement on peace will be in the interest of both sides and enforced by both sides. And President Kennedy carried the day when the Senate voted 80-19 to ratify the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. That is leadership. That is an expression of the true common good. That is what is possible today. Thank you very much.
Professor Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University. That's all we have time for here this week on Conscious Voices. I'm Evan Davis. I'll be here with you again next week on another edition when it airs at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP now broadcasting at 91.9 FM in Columbus, Ohio. See you next week. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.